Joe Walton, among others. 2013. The beautifully titled novel, among others, is, I suppose, a fairy tale, since there are fairies in it, or anyhow, beings called fairies. They aren't visible to everyone, yet can affect the lives of people who don't see them or don't believe in them, in that they play in modern industrial England something like their role in the folklore of the past. They don't, however, fit conventional notions of fairy-likeness. They aren't the tall, fair ones who carry you off under the hill, nor yet the tiny peas blossoms and sprites the Victorians loved, and they are most definitely not Tinker Bell. Descriptions suggest that the great illustrator Arthur Rackham was one of the people who could see them. In the same way that oak trees have acorns, and hand-shaped leaves and hazels have hazelnuts with little curved leaves, most fairies are gnarly and gray, or green or brown, and there's generally something hairy about them somewhere. This one was gray, very gnarly indeed, and well over towards the hideous part of the spectrum. Maury, the protagonist and narrator of the novel, has always seen and known the fairies, though she'd like them to be Tolkien's elves. They aren't gracious and powerful, but frustrated, marginal, somehow diminished. Some of them are probably ghosts. They are untamed, uncivilized, and unpredictable. They speak Welsh, mostly. They don't answer to any name, but if asked properly, they can grant wishes. They are like fragments of the wild, surviving only where a trace of woodland survives, haunting whatever remains of the unhuman, old parks, pre-industrial untilled places, forgotten roads out past the edges of towns and farms. Among others does not, however, make the trite equation of wilderness with magic, for several quite commonplace-seeming human beings in the story also have supernatural powers. The knowledge of how to ask the fairies to grant a wish is one kind of magic, but there are others, some much nastier. Bringing supernatural events into ordinary modern life, in this case, Oswestry in 1979, isn't an easy business for a novelist. The realists left us with the notion that fantasy is acceptable only when presented as about or for children. But there's nothing inherently childish about the overlapping of the natural with the supernatural, and many novels written for adults, even in the heyday of realism, involve that overlap. The first that came to my mind was the subtle and charming Lady Into Fox. In David Garnett's story, as in many others, the supernatural element is simply there, not explained, not discussed. A good aesthetic ploy. For if it is discussed, the author has to tackle both plausibility and causality head-on. Most fantasies evade both these great and very challenging opportunities to make the impossible plausible. To give magic accountability in a realistic setting and moral and emotional weight in a modern novel. Joe Walton accepts the double challenge and meets it with courage and skill. She shows how easily the effects of a magic spell can be seen and explained away as perfectly natural, and how every action that brings about real change must be paid for. A reciprocity as absolute in the world of three wishes as it is in the world of Newton's third law. The narrative of the diary of 15-year-old Maury. But Maury, as an adult, is implicitly present, and this stereotypical vision greatly enriches the book. Maury writes with style and reads obsessively. Mostly science fiction. Some readers of the novel will be floored by her critical comments, enthusiastic or disapproving, about authors they may never have heard of. This strikes me as only fair. Since we no longer have a common literary culture, many readers are floored by references to classical authors they've never been introduced to. Anyhow, given the chance, Maury devours Plato as eagerly as she does Heinlein or Zelazny. Her critical notes, delivered with the energetic conviction of her age, are a delight. I was glad to learn that T.S. Eliot is Brill. Having suffered a lot of major damage, physical and psychic, Maury sees her reading as compensatory. In fact, books give her passion and her fierce intelligence their only access to larger realities of art and thought. Books are almost enough to get her through separation from everyone she has loved, the pain of a smashed pelvis, the suffocating pettiness of the girls' boarding school that her three very respectable and very strange aunts have sent her to, and the uncanny attacks of an insane witch, her mother. But even reading fails her at last, and in search of some companionship, some human warmth in her life, she resorts to working magic. Among others is a funny, thoughtful, acute, and absorbing story all through. But in the magic bits, it is more than that. When Maury realizes that perhaps her new friends did not choose to offer her friendship, but were forced to do so by the spell she laid upon them, her moral anguish is that of anyone who honestly faces the responsibility of power. And it is not soon or easily resolved. The heart of the book is a scene in the Welsh hills, where Maury obeys the fairy's command to help the souls of the dead go into the darkness on All Souls' Eve. In the crash that crippled Maury, her twin sister was killed, and the sister's soul comes to the gate of darkness now and clings and clutches and will not let Maury let her go. In this passage, haunting in its reticence and its drama, all the anguish of loss and need gathers almost intolerably, and as in some old ballads, the quiet, factual narration deepens the inexplicable experience, making strangeness real.